You are listening to the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast, the official podcast of the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Here's your host, Tyus France.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for tuning into the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Tyus France. Sitting across the city from me is Alex. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tyus.
So we're doing these remote podcasts, but boy, they're so much easier for us to do. We can roll out of bed and start recording, so bear with us on those. We've got a bunch to talk about. There's last week we did the first one where Sam did an interview, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. It involved the Tuttle Twins, those book series, which is a really, really cool book series, and I think they've got a couple more still to come out. So if you're trying to get the entire set, sorry, you're gonna have to wait. But if you didn't catch that interview, go back to the last episode where you'll be able to hear it. It's really, really cool. And today we've got a bunch of stuff that we missed because we didn't do one last week. So I guess the big news, the sad news, we'll start off with the really depressing stuff, is the Florida school shooting took place. And I was oddly in a gun store as I looked up at the news and saw that there was a shooting that took place. I believe 17, 18 people were killed in it, most of which are students, some of which were faculty. There was a lot of news about the shooter being reported in several different places, in fact. It looked like the public had known this guy was kind of out there. He had posted on YouTube, on a YouTube comment, that he was going to be like a professional school shooter, and he was reported to the FBI, and they did an investigation. But the challenge on that is he hadn't committed a crime yet. So they can't just go out and arrest somebody when they say something stupid, because if you do that, you've got to violate people's First Amendment rights. It was a challenging situation, and now, of course, in the wake of it, there's a few sides that everybody seems to pop up with, one of which is, you know, saying your prayers are with the victims is not good enough, and they want action, and so there's one side there. Then there's a lot of people that are asking for a ban on assault weapons, requiring increased registration, increased background checks. There's that end of it. There's the other end of it, which I don't actually see very often after a shooting, which is they want to arm the teachers. So there's a whole movement around arming the teachers, which is really the opposite end of it when it comes to, after these shootings, usually it's, you know, disarm people. And this is the first time I've seen where they're saying, well, maybe we should arm people. And they have a little bit of a point to that. You know, when we see these, they almost always happen in gun-free zones. They happen where concerts are taking place and people have been searched by security before being able to go in, or in movie theaters where the establishment says we don't want guns, or schools where guns are not allowed. You never see these happening inside of a gun store because, well, a gun store can fire back. And so people are arguing, well, maybe we should arm the teachers. And it's an interesting stance. It's not one that I want to say that's a good idea or a bad idea. In my head, I'd kind of like it to be voluntary, obviously. I want the teachers to be able to do what they want to do with themselves because, hey, libertarian, remember, that's the whole podcast. But then on the other end of that, all the banning the assault weapons, I think that's a terrible idea. Why? Well, because assault weapons are really a made-up term. We don't even know what that really means. What they basically mean is we don't want AR-15s out there. But if you start down that road, AR-15s do not end up with creating the greatest amount of violence in our country. Handguns do. So at what point do you just start redefining what you're trying to ban? Ultimately, they said, oh, we're not trying to take your guns away. We're just trying to limit the really dangerous ones. Well, the really dangerous ones are not the big rifles. They happen to be the handguns, or the ones that are easiest to conceal, or the ones that people have on them. It's like the best camera you have is the camera you have on you. Well, when violence and terrible things take place, it's often the weapon that a person has available to them, whether that's a gun or a kitchen knife or a bucket of bleach, who knows. They also want to require a greater registry of handguns. So they want everybody to register their handguns, or guns in general. But in doing so, When you do that, if people fail to register their handguns, you've instantly made criminals out of a massive percentage of the population. Those that don't register their handguns are now in trouble for not registering their handguns. And a registry actually doesn't do anything. So if a registry is going to say, oh, these people have weapons, but in the same way that this shooter was reported to the FBI in advance, well, they already knew he was a threat, but they couldn't do anything about it because he hadn't broken any laws. So a registry doesn't really do anything unless you know the guy has the weapons, you know where he plans on using them, unless there's some way of preemptively getting in front of it. But knowing that somebody has a handgun or a weapon of any kind does nothing. And then the last one is they want to increase background checks, which I don't really have that big of an issue with. I would like it to be run by the establishment. So I would love these background checks to be privatized. I guess a greater concern on that is if it's done by the state, if these background checks are done by the state, isn't that the state having the right to discriminate one citizen against another, which should be a violation of a Second Amendment right? However, if it is a gun store or that is putting these efforts in place, they could set their terms as far as how high or low their threshold is on these, and the free market could decide what is a reasonable and unreasonable background check for people to go through when purchasing a weapon. Alex, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I mean, first off, I do feel so much for the victims as well as the survivors. You know, in some ways, it's almost harder to be a survivor of a tragedy than it is a victim, simply because you have to live through the aftermath. You have to try to put the pieces of your life back together. Can't imagine being a parent having to bury your child. That's just a pain I wouldn't hope anybody ever had to go through again. And so, first off, I think that statement of sympathy, I can't empathize. I've been fortunate not to be in any kind of mass shooting or be the family or member or loved one of a victim, but I have met people who are in the aftermath of the Vegas tragedy that was here this last fall, and it's certainly a very unfortunate, very sad event and totally unnecessary to take place. So there's a lot of things that I think that we've, you know, talked about here. Obviously, not a fan of any kind of gun control, not least of which because it would have actually made the situation worse, potentially. I think that what you're dealing with is you got 98% of mass shootings taking place in gun-free zones, and by taking away more guns, you've created more gun-free zones, which means that you're going to see even more bolder attacks because they do know that the only way to answer a gun is with a gun. And if there was a magic fairy wand that we could wave and it took away everyone's guns, the government's, the people's, the police's, everybody's, then that would be possible to enforce gun control. You know what I mean, Tyus? Like, if I could just wave, yeah. If I had magic, right, I could make sure that both the criminals, the government, and the people, none of them have weapons, so no one can blow each other away in that sense. But we all know that, practically speaking, never going to happen. First of all, the government will never disarm. And people who are the British and the Australian, you know, their military still has weapons. Their police still have weapons. And don't tell me, oh, well, the police don't carry their guns. But they have them. Like, if things broke out bad enough in the UK, they're going to have guns out on the street. Why? Because that's how they're going to be able to out-firepower anybody else. That is the people. And that was exactly what the framers didn't want. They didn't want, and in fact, Alexander Hamilton wrote quite eloquently about this in the Federalist Paper number 8. I was reminded of this quote earlier this week by a friend of mine. But basically, the gist of it is that the soldiery, as he calls it, the military, should never make the people should never love or hate them, right? It should be kind of a, well, we have to have this for our mutual defense, but, you know, if it was a perfect world, we wouldn't even have a military, but since we kind of have to protect ourselves against the British and whoever else, then we kind of have to tolerate it, but that they should be such a small percentage of the population that they couldn't outweigh the will of the people. And we still, even though there's a lot of military, active duty military members today, they're still a minority compared to the entire American people. And so that's how we kind of keep a balance there. And you know, in a similar way, you know, having weapons for the citizenry helps maintain that balance that makes sure that the government doesn't come back and say, you know, actually, we don't like, you know, your religion, or we don't like your color skin. And that's always my concern, right, is that who are the people that are going to get their guns taken away? My guess is it's not going to be rich, white, you know, property owners that have billions of dollars invested in the market and make regular tens of thousand dollar contributions to political candidates. No. My guess is that if there are gun control laws, they're going to go into the poor and minority-dominated communities. They're going to take away weapons from people who are just fighting for their lives because the police aren't there to do anything else except enforce dumb laws. And so what you end up with is you end up with a minority community that can't fight back against gangs and other criminal activity that know they can't fight back. And so they choose to target those areas and because they know that that there's such a strict gun control and drug enforcement policy in those areas, they know that people aren't going to call the police. You might have illegal immigrants. They're not going to call the police. They have no way of keeping, you know, law and order there. And if you take away those legally obtained weapons, they have nothing else to fight back with. They have no way to protect their children. And I wouldn't want to tell any 19-year-old mother in the you know, perhaps poorer areas of Las Vegas, I wouldn't want to tell any 19-year-old single mother, no, you can't protect your two kids because, gosh, one of them may or may not someday, in like a 1 out of 1 million chance, take that weapon to school. And not even shoot anybody, but just take it with them, right? I don't think that her right to defend herself and her children should be trampled upon for any tragedy. And you and I have talked before, Tyus, about how every time there's a tragedy, there are political opportunists on both sides that see this as their opportunity to craft the narrative, to frame the narrative. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely.
So, yeah, and so I guess in conclusion, I'd have to say gun control is not an effective measure, and there are effective measures we can take, but I'll leave you with this. I don't think the problem's going to be solved by any one person or even any overall group of people. And the reason is because every community has slightly different needs. Just like you have different educational needs, you have different security needs. In some areas, you might have gang activity, so you're going to have security measures against those. In other measures, or in other schools, you might have more chances of a lone wolf, and so that's who you're looking for. You might be looking for any number of risk factors, one of which is bullying, and getting these people counseling and help early to help make sure that they are well-adjusted. Anti-bullying campaigns are helpful with this. Also, just giving kids the emotional tools to deal with bullying very much helps with this. But there are just so many good solutions out there. And I believe that the reason they're not being implemented is because we always try to find the one-size-fits-all solution. And when we try to tackle this problem as just one big problem, it's very difficult. And in physics and computer science, the area I work in primarily, we often do things, we call it divide-and-conquer algorithms, after the military, you know, kind of term. The idea is that sometimes you have to conquer a big problem by conquering a lot of smaller problems. And in my mind, if each school was given the ability to choose the security measures that their parents wanted, their parents demanded, that you would get a much better system. Because in some areas, you may not need as many security measures. And in other areas, they might demand a guard shack and pay for guards and all of this. I think that that's up to the parents. But instead, what we do is we say, well, you're going to have to wait and just have whatever the school district decides for the whole county, you know, or the Department of Education for the whole country. And then you end up with parents who are like, why aren't we getting adequate security? Why is this other school getting it? You know, this sort of thing. When it really should be on a school-by-school, parent-by-parent basis for where do I want to send my kids? And I'm betting you, Tyus, that a lot of parents would shell out a lot of money to send their kids to a school that had armed security if they're worried about mass shootings.
Yeah, it's a great point. I'm all for the privatization of those schools if we get there. But you know, that's me in the anarchy role.
Right.
One point that you brought up that I think is really, really valid is that we're actually never talking about really disarming guns. So I've got a quote from Stephen Molyneux. God, could you have a harder last name to spell?
Anything if anybody French.
Has not seen this, it's the craziest spelling. You shouldn't have a Y and an X in one word. Okay, so anyways, he wrote, if you are for gun control, then you are not against guns because the guns will be needed to disarm the people. So it's not that you're anti-gun. You'll need the police guns to take away the people's guns. So you're very pro-gun. You just believe the only government, which of course is so reliable, honest, moral, and virtuous, should be allowed to have guns. There's no such thing as gun control. There's only centralized gun ownership at the hands of small political elite and their minions.
Yeah, so I don't trust Donald Trump with my guns. Sorry.
Yeah, he's bringing up the exact same point that you just said. Like, it's not, they're not going away. It's just, who are you comfortable with having them? Another Charlie Rangel. He's a representative from New York. He was interviewed on Fox News. And so he was quoted as saying, law-abiding citizens just should not have to carry a gun. So the reporter said, but you're protected by guns all over the place here at the Capitol. And he said, well, that's a little different. I think we need to protection down here. So he's basically saying, the people shouldn't have guns. We can't trust the people, but it's totally different. If you're a politician on high, then having these private protection is completely reasonable. And that's exactly what we should be avoiding, is people with that stance. Not to mention the fact that we know what happens when we do prohibitions. We did a prohibition on marijuana, or we've had one for quite a while. And you know what pops up? Cartels that move these things around. And strangely enough, the violence rate goes up under prohibitions, whether they're drugs or alcohol. We see increases in crime, and I can only imagine that if the prohibition becomes on weapons, the violence is going to get really, really out of hand with people trying to obtain them illegally.
It'll mean ultimately to those listening who are very concerned about this, it'll mean more dead cops and more dead black market, movers. That's where that extra violence comes from. So if you're pro-cop, you really ought to be anti these dumb laws, because that's getting them killed every other day, because they're having to enforce laws that really shouldn't be laws. And I think all of us can agree on the drug ones. Obviously, there's probably a 50-50 divide, maybe not in our audience, but 50-50 divide in the country on whether or not guns should be illegal. But what you're doing is you're creating a huge black market for weapons. And this is already in existence for weapons that have already been banned. And I can tell you, the ATF isn't keeping up with it. routinely, you see these, there are busts. So we know that occasionally they find that people have been operating under their nose, billion-dollar arms smuggling industry. And unfortunately, it's probably true that even our own Central Intelligence Agency makes huge use of these black markets, because otherwise they couldn't get their guns into the hands of their people overseas. They can't just ship a crate with love from the United States of America. And so there's a lot of gun control doesn't work. Automatic weapons are still bought and sold on the black market, but now only the most powerful and interested criminals are able to obtain them. And that, to me, is a really bad sign. I think that the right to defend your family is one of the most fundamental rights, and yourself, but, the right to defend yourself and your family is one of the most fundamental rights, human rights, that go beyond any government. I think it's something that you would have seen on the stone tablets of ancient Mesopotamia, that people have that right. That's one of the things that goes back that far in our human history, because you always have the right to self-defense. Guns are effective measures for self-defense, and just the fear of there being guns around often proved to be as effective as actually having them. So, I just, again, to reiterate, there are a lot of solutions to help reduce mass shootings. but almost none of them involve any kind of weaponry. A lot of them do deal with the fact that we put zero money, hardly any money, into our mental health facilities. And the fact is that social psychologists have established a firm link between bullying and probability of becoming a mass shooter. And it's those who are bullied who are likely to become a mass shooter. And so people who are consistently bullied, and then there's a number of additional risk factors, like if you've had stuff stolen from you at school, if you've had this research is out there. So if you want to cut off mass shooters at the source, you got to tackle this bullying problem by giving kids the tools to deal with bullies, the emotional wherewithal to deal with that, because you're going to encounter bullies all throughout your life. And, you know, not everyone has a supportive, loving family at home to help them get through that. I was very fortunate in that regard, even though I was bullied, you know, quite a bit as a kid. I had a mom and dad at home that were like, you know, it's about them, it's not about you, all of this sort of thing. But there are kids not getting that. And if we want to prevent, we want to cut off these mass shooters at the source, who are ultimately the criminals, right? Not the guns, but the actual mass shooters are the people we should be blaming. But let's stop making them in this country. And we're not making them through video game violence. We're not making them through any of these other dumb what-if scenarios that people love to propose. There is established, well-documented scientific research on the risk factors involved, and the first one that they found was that you were bullied consistently. And so this is something that if we tackle it, we will see the number of mass shooters drop, period. Because people who are healthy and well-adjusted don't shoot up at school. This is obvious, but, you know, it's unfortunate that people want to find, they want to blame something that seems right, but they don't really want to look further and see, gosh, we've had 15, 20 years of really horrendous media hyped mass shootings, and we have got decades of research now into the causes, or at least the correlations, and correlations is good enough, right? At least now you know which kids you need to be giving them extra emotional support and extra tools to deal with, compartmentalize certain areas, deal with the bullying head on in an emotionally healthy way. These are the sorts of things we should be doing. And that's why I want to draw a distinction between some of these anti-bullying campaigns whose goal is to eliminate all bullies. Well, that's never going to happen either. What you can do is you can give the victims of bullying the emotional tools they need so that when they are bullied, they don't deal with that in a negative, bottled-up way that comes out as a mass shooting in 15 years. They deal with it in a healthy, that's not about me, that's about them kind of a way. And then they just continue living their life, and they go on to become well-adjusted members of society. So anyway, that was my like ramble about what...
Preach on. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, and there are solutions, though, but we're not listening to what they are. We need to be listening to, with a social science, wow, I can't even say that phrase. We need to be listening
social
to...
Social scientists?
The social scientists, wow, that's really hard for me this morning, are saying to do, so.
Yeah. So let's transition from this story, which is very, very important, to a story that is not at all important. Because that seems to be what our culture does across the country. We focus our attention on the stuff that doesn't really matter, and we make memes about the stuff that does. One of the things that has been making the news everywhere is the new Black Panther movie, which I did have the privilege of going out and seeing, and I might do some spoilers in this. So if you haven't seen the movie, then I don't know how they're making so much money. Yeah, spoiler alert, it's coming. But you probably have seen the movie because it's broken all box office records and seems like every capacity. They've absolutely dominated. And so a couple of things about this that I figure are worth mentioning. So one is there is a lot of absolute craziness about race within this. Just because the cast is primarily black, and maybe the title called Black Panther, but it's really not a racial movie. I mean, there's talk about culture in it quite a bit, and some of the plot lines within the culture are very, very interesting. So, for example, both the hero and the villain are are characters that lost their father at a young age to black-on-black violence, which I hate to say it, but like there is kind of a little bit of an epidemic of that situation of children raised by single family members, black on black crime. Also, okay, here's the big spoiler. I'm going to ruin the end of the movie right now. Alex, have you seen this movie?
I haven't, but that's all right because I haven't seen any new movies in theaters in like 2.5 years. I just wait and watch it at home on my home theater.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I'm about to destroy the end of this for you.
Okay.
So the general plot of this is you've got a prince who becomes a king because, you know, somebody kills his dad. And so he's this prince who has all of this technology, basically unlimited wealth, and superpowers. So he's kind of got everything going on for him. And then you have a villain that is made by... He's created by society killing his dad and being left in poverty, and he's trying to make it and trying to ascend. So the high point in the movie is he takes over the role of king. And the end of the movie is the original king gets it back. So there's really... I left going, what was wrong about this movie? And it starts about the strong, rich, powerful being on top, and it ends with the exact same strong, rich, powerful being on top. And the lowly person that's trying to ascend, that's trying to make it, that doesn't have all the opportunities, but man, he sure is trying to, you know, pull himself up by his bootstraps. Well, he loses in this. And that really kind of bothered me. I was like, something is wrong about this plot. It's not following like Dave Campbell's The Hero's Journey or whatever. So anyways, that's my critique of my issues with the movie was that it was a little bit overdone as far as computer animation. Okay, so that's all the negative. Outside of that, this movie's fantastic. It's absolutely wonderful. You should go see it. It's visually spectacular. It's really, really fun. It's not actually racial. I don't see a whole lot of stuff where that becomes a giant factor. I mean, they mention, right at the very end, they mention, like, being a slave, but among the history of their people. But it's really not a white versus black thing. And I've seen tweets where people have said, you know what, I'm not going to go see the Black Panther movie because I don't want to be a white person in the theater taking away from black joy. When do you think it would be appropriate for me to go see this movie? To which I think you guys are out of your mind. It's a movie. Go enjoy it if you want to, or don't see it. But you guys don't have to make it a racial thing because there happens to be a black cast in place.
Right.
It's crazy. There was a tweet. Who put it out? I responded to it because I thought it was crazy. But I think it was Serena Williams. She might have retweeted it. Anyways. It was, name a black superhero that doesn't have the word black in their name. And so, again, they were making the point that, man, this is all about race. This is all about race. Well, I went and I responded. I was like, well, she has like 100 superheroes that don't have the word black in their name.
Most notably, very sexy Green Lantern, who's always been a favorite of mine. I loved Green Lantern growing up.
Isn't it offensive that they're making all of these characters into green characters now? Now it's all about color. I think it's ridiculous. And honestly, it doesn't matter at all. So all of this news coverage that is about race among this one blockbuster movie is just an absolute waste of time. So let's move to... it's crazy. Let's move to something that is, I think, much more important that's not being covered in the news. Or at least I haven't really seen much news on it. And it's regarding Harvard University. So Harvard University has officially banned single-gender clubs unless they're women only. So they were working on this last year. They were talking about, you know what, we don't want to have any clubs that are about single gender. So that includes fraternities, sororities. There's these clubs that I guess are called finals clubs, which are basically ways for alumni to get together. But they're often brought together around these fraternities or sororities. So Harvard was saying, you know what, this is kind of exclusionary, so we don't like it. We're not into this. So we're going to block these. Well, they passed that, and pretty much immediately, feminists stepped forward and said, hey, we're not okay with you blocking this, women's groups being able to join together, because women have been oppressed while men haven't. So it's okay that you block any groups that involve men, but it's not okay that you block groups that are women, which somehow, incredibly, the college said, okay. And so now it is okay if you are a women's only group. However, if you are a men's group, if you are a fraternity, you are penalized. So they will, I forget all the different things they're going to do with you, but they may, you may be barred from leadership positions, athletic teams, or scholarships might be removed from you if you are a man that wants to hang out with men. Now, this should violate, what is it, Section 19 or whatever it is? Basically, colleges are not allowed to discriminate. There's a law in place around this. But they're not actually, these clubs are not by the college. These clubs are outside of the college that students are going to. So this is really violating people's free right to associate. Now, the college is private, so the college can do whatever it wants. But I hope people see this for what it is, as just flat out sexist. And come together and be like, you know what, I don't think I want to go to a college that is that absolutely, that's crazy. It's absolutely insane.
That and when say, they end up, they're going to end up with a 100% female school someday, because men that go there are going to continually to feel like they aren't allowed to have any groups. And it's kind of silly, because I'm sure they have sports teams that are men only because they have to, because the NCAA says you have to. So are they disbanding the sports teams? Because that's an all-male club. If you're an all-male hockey team, if you're an all-male football team. So this is just dumb. That's a great point. This is just really dumb, and it's just the liberals eating themselves alive on this issue. And honestly, I don't know. I don't want to say I don't care, but I can certainly say that I'm not going to send my kid to a school which will discriminate against him or her on the basis of his or her gender. It's just not something that should be done. These colleges are so about their metrics now, and they're fucking, you know, it's just so, it's really frustrating. You should always get into college and excel based on your merit. And whoever the most meritorious are, they should be the ones getting to go. As heartbreaking and hard as that is for some people who are of privilege and are used to getting into everything, they're going to have to deal with the fact that, you know, these educational institutions really ought to be focused on the people who are going to go on to cure cancer. But they also have to kind of probably consider the endowments and all of this sort of thing. So, you know, maybe there's some reasonable, you know, accommodation there. But like UNLV here in Las Vegas prides themselves on being one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse campus in the entire country. And I was sitting there going, that doesn't make me want to go there. Though diversity is important, it shouldn't be forced. It shouldn't be something that they've worked to have. You should be a college where people want to go there from all types of and walks and backgrounds, not because you said, well, we need to admit four more black women. I don't know very many black women that want to get in just because they're a black woman. In fact, I think they'd slap you if you said that. And I had a lot of friends that were female physics majors in college. And we often discuss this very issue, because I went to a 70% female school, so there were several female physics majors, and so we had a discussion in our club about this very topic. And I remember one of the, and I won't say her name in case she doesn't want to be, you know, recognized for this, but basically she said, the gist of what she said is, I don't want to get into doctoral school someday for physics and wonder if I got in just because I was a woman. That really was powerful to me, because what she's saying is that I want to get in because I was better than the other men that could have gotten in, or women, not because I happened to be a woman that was better than other women, right? She wants to be the best, and I so respect and admire that, and I think that's the view that most women hold, is they just want to be viewed as a person trying to become a scientist, or a person trying to become a politician, or a person trying to become gosh, I can't even think, but automobile technician or something, right? Some male-dominated fields. And so I think that it's very, I think this is the right attitude, right? Is that we want, I'm gay. I can tell you that I don't want to be seen as one of the little statistics for them. I want to be seen as I was hired because I was a really good software engineer. I was very respectful. I work well with others, right? These are the qualities I want to get hired for, not because I am gay, and so they have to have one gay, you know, so they can say, oh, here's our gay guy. We don't discriminate. And, you know, I don't want that. I don't want to ever wonder, was that why I was hired? You know, not that I make it super apparent when I'm in a professional setting, but, you know, I don't want anybody to be like, oh, well, that must be, you know, that's why he got in. You know, that completely defeats the purpose of what you were trying to set up. And in fact, I think that entrenches these gendered and sexuality and racial divisions, because you basically draw attention to them when what we ought to be doing is we ought to be saying, these don't actually matter in any way.
Yep. You shouldn't have to be judged by it. You shouldn't have to hide and say, hey, I don't want anybody to know I'm gay. But on the other hand, you also shouldn't have to say, hey, I'm gay, so they should hire me because of that, because it's going to increase their diversity. Like, in both cases, it's absolutely insane. It doesn't relate to what it's about. But ultimately, this is this college essentially putting another nail in their own coffin. In an effort to try and become diverse and all of that, they reduce diversity by doing so. It's a joke, but it's actually happening, and this is the kind of stuff that actually really pisses me off. At some point in the future, I think we should do a whole episode just on universities, because there is a lot to unpack around student debt, around admissions, around all that stuff. So maybe we'll cover a whole episode in the future just on that topic. Let's move on to another one that gets me all titillated, which is Trump has proposed to remove tax exemption from Scientology. So full transparency, I'm an atheist, so I don't have really any vested interest in churches, but I do believe that people should have the right to believe whatever they want. I'm also a huge supporter of the separation of church and state. But being an atheist, you know, I go on the, from my personal belief, I go, oh, I don't think that any religion is really valid. So why should they have tax exemption? And to go down that road a little further, the answer to me is, I don't think anybody should be dealing with taxes. So why not make everybody tax exempt? A lot of people are seeing this story and they're going, yeah, they shouldn't be tax exempt. All these churches shouldn't be tax exempt. And I look at it and I say, well, on one hand, if you take away tax exemption for churches, suddenly the churches have real justification for lobbying and for doing everything they can to control the government. And there's a lot of power there. It's a $70 billion company.
Oh, yeah.
$70 billion, right? So, yes, the government will grow because they'll be taxing the $70 billion. So they'll take in, you know, somewhere around $21 billion of that. So that's growth to the government. But more concerning is, if these are religions that you don't necessarily agree with, imagine them basing government policy around religious viewpoint, because that's the threat we're talking about. That's what we're talking about doing with this.
This is what they do in the Middle East. Very
concerning.
Yeah, this is what they do in the Middle East that scares everybody so much. The Sharia law. This is what happens when you allow religious leaders to not only interfere with, but to dominate political roles as well. You end up with these religious tribunals that end up throwing gay men that are even just suspected gay men off of buildings. That's justice for them. And you know what? Religion has sent us to the Crusades. It has killed more than pretty much any single cause other than disease and old age. But religion is a number one killer. And because religion says kill that which is different in a lot of ways, not all religions, but honestly, not even a lot of the religions that have been responsible for it. But unfortunately, you have one pope or you have one king or somebody that says, this is what I think the Bible says, or this is what I think the Tao Te Ching says, and they use that as justification for mass murder. And the governments do this too, but to a much lesser degree than religious war, right? A religious war is a holy war. It's something that you're being sent on this mission by a higher power. And so how could you possibly dispute the wisdom of a higher power? You can't. You turn off critical thinking, because faith is about believing, and I am a person of faith. Faith, I can tell you, is a belief in something that can't be proven, right? It's a belief that you hold where there's no evidence. And that might surprise some of our listeners who hear me talking about evidence all the time. But I think it's okay to believe in Hogwarts or Santa, because there's no evidence that they don't exist. There's not like a we haven't scanned the entire Earth to the degree where we can say 100% there isn't, right? And so if you want to believe in that, I think that you can. I think that's if that's a powerful way to help you get through life, which sucks in a lot of ways, I think that that should be totally your right to do that. And no one can tell you that you're wrong simply because they can't prove that you're wrong. That's the whole idea. Now, if you believe in something that is proven true or false, and then you continue believing that the earth is flat, then that's not religion, that's just stupidity. But, you know, like these people that don't believe in the Big Bang, it's like, well, okay, but this is the explanation for cosmic microwave background. You don't get to choose another one unless you can prove that there's a flaw in the current theory. And so far, it's been consistent with all experimental data. So anyway, sorry, I had to throw in some science because we're talking about religion. and so basically, you know, religion, and so string theory is actually another example of a religion, right? It can't be proven. It's below the Planck length. You can't design an experiment that can detect something to the point that's below a Planck length, which is the inherent in the uncertainty principle. And so believing in string theory is simply a mathematician's explanation for how the universe exists and is formed and this sort of thing. But it is equally valid at this point. At this point in our scientific knowledge, it's equally valid as God snapped his fingers and it appeared, or it randomly exploded together, or however, you know, people think that things came to be. Those are all equally valid explanations, simply because we can't measure. In fact, that's what the Planck length is saying, is that at the moment we believe we can't measure below this, simply because there's no way to be sure what we're detecting down there. There's an uncertain probabilistic universe at below that length. And so, you know, we can't account for it well enough in order to establish what's actually happening down there. And so, in my mind, what we've said in science is that fundamentally, our universe is probabilistic and is happening by random chance. And so, that gives a lot of wiggle room to believe in what you want to believe in, without there being any real contradictions in science, at least not forthcoming soon, based on current theory. And so, you know, and so back to the point about the whole, of course, church and state thing is, you know, to me it's despicable that we would want our churches to be involved in the political process. They should be involved exclusively in the humanitarian process. They should be the private charity. They should be a subset of the private charities out there helping the poor, the sick, and the needy, doing missions in Africa, building homes, you know, Habitat for Humanity, doing water in Africa. You know, these are the sorts of things that I think that, you know, make them eligible for nonprofit status. And if we wanted to allow them to be paying taxes, we'd have to allow them, just like corporations, to lobby. And I'm very afraid of what a 200 million person, you know, lobby might be able to accomplish. I mean, I don't know about you, Tyus, but that scares me, and I'm a person of faith, because we've seen this happen historically.
I think if we were to see that, like the efforts that have been made in marriage equality, I'm pretty sure that just would say, nope, that's not going to happen. If you're interested in sexual reproductive rights, as far as things like birth control, like these are things that you might have to wave goodbye to when you're looking at enough money, and we're talking about a lot of money, like massive amounts of money that could get behind this stuff. We know that religions do push agendas politically. They're not allowed to, but we know it happens. And that's, I mean, it's okay. Things like that are going to happen. But the moment you open the floodgate, That's a whole different ball game, and that's really what you're inviting in by saying, "Oh, let's tax all these organizations." Not to mention the fact that in my brain, the whole taxation thing is theft, right? So right. By saying, "Hey, let's tax all of the any religion," I look at that and I'm like, "Well, first off, it's theft, so that's bad." So I look at it the other way, and I'm like, "Let's make everybody tax exempt." You know, let's make them buy the rights that they want, or not the rights. I shouldn't say that because that's going to come down and make it sound like the Bill of Rights is up for sale. But I mean, if they want additional privileges, let's have people pay for those additional privileges. Let's not forcibly take them from people by taking their money.
Yeah.
So the whole separation of church and state is very, very important. And you got into probability, and we could go deep into what is reasonable, what isn't. I don't really care if it's reasonable. If you want to believe in the flying spaghetti monster, the celestial teapot, an invisible man, I don't care. You have the right to whatever belief you want. And strangely enough, I'll defend your right to believe it because it's the only thing that protects me from having the right to believe what I believe.
Exactly.
So even if I think you're totally wrong, I'm going to stand behind you and say, you know what? I disagree. I totally disagree. But if you are not causing harm to others, I'm going to stand behind you and say you have the right to believe it. Because I want to protect my right to believe whatever I want to believe. That's the only way I can protect myself. Now, Alex, you had mentioned that there's kind of a prayer going on before political meetings. What was that about?
So it's very common that in formal meetings, and in fact, most legislatures will open with what's called an invocation, and they'll exit with what's called a benediction. And basically, these are prayers for the meeting, for it to be successful and all of this. But I've often seen that the vast majority of these are performed as kind of a very Protestant Christian religious ceremony. Bow your heads. We all say amen afterwards. We thank dear baby Jesus. And I happen to believe in all this, by the way, for those who are listening. So, you know, my bias, if anything, would be to do this, but I feel very uncomfortable knowing that there's other people that are Jewish or Catholic or Muslim or anything sitting there having to listen to this. And I'm just very, it kind of hurts me because I know that, you know, this is the sort of thing that I would expect like Pharisees to do. I wouldn't expect, a Christ follower to be forcing this on people. Certainly not at the beginning of some large political meeting. I never, you know, once can remember Jesus or anybody in the Bible going down to City Hall, so to speak, and you know, demanding this or that. Right? He was with the people. I think that as a person of faith, that what we have to do is we have to say, you know, this is really not appropriate in our government, because what we're really saying is we're saying this is the one true religion for our government. And I'm not saying that you can't have a religion, you can't mention God. I'm not saying any of that. I'm just saying that having a formal prayer, both before and after a meeting, to a higher power is kind of exclusionary government-wise to the 40-45% of the country that doesn't believe in Protestant Christianity. And, I know as a gay male that you know, we're something like 4-5% of the population. I'm pretty sure that I would not be comfortable with a prayer that said, let's find that, you know, let's believe in your word that says that homosexuality is a crime, or, you know, or that women's place is in the home. There's all sorts of things that I have a real problem with that you could tie to a book, no matter which book you're referring to, or no book, right? You could go to the opposite extreme. But it really bothers me, and I think this is something that we have to just start, you know, stop doing. We have to start having the conversation of, if this is a government for the people, if this is a government for the American people that have some huge diversity of religions, and it's phenomenal, and it's great that we have the freedom of religion here, but I don't think that our forefather, and honestly, I think our forefathers sort of foretold the end of the religious ceremonies in a lot of these meetings, because they were very explicit about trying at least to separate church and state, and they, you know, considering the times that they were in, I think that they did a pretty good first, you know, attempt at that. But now I think it's time for the clean break. I think that in order for me to be able to practice my religion how I want to, where I want to, when I want to, I don't want the government to be involved in any of it. I don't want the government to regulate it, tax it, choose who gets it, and I don't want them to be inviting only certain religions to open up with a prayer. I think that, there's a way to open up a meeting that doesn't involve, first of all, unblinding allegiance to a flag, which is something that that I'm sure our forefathers are rolling in their graves over, and it doesn't have to involve any kind of invocation or benediction. I think that we can start and end these meetings simply saying that I hope today, right, statement of hope, right, that's what this is really about. It's not really about faith, so let's remove the faith from it so that I can be free to practice that very, you know, time-honored tradition in my own church, but I don't have to force others to participate in that just to become an elected official or just to go to a political meeting. And I know the Libertarian Party of Nevada is welcoming to all religious and non-religious people, and so we have it as a policy to never do an invocation or benediction, even a non-religious one or non-religious specific one, because it harkens back to this tradition that I know would turn me off if it was a different one. I can't imagine many Christians would want to attend a prayer that began in, that was an Islamic prayer in the beginning. And I think that if we started doing something extreme like that, how quickly would people decide we don't need to do this in the government anymore? That's how we make these other people feel. And so if you're uncomfortable with me saying this, just imagine if we had to start every single political meeting with a 5-minute sung prayer, and then afterwards we had to try and go back to what we were doing. I feel like I think I know most Christians would have a problem with this, and rightly so. We shouldn't treat others the way we don't want to be treated, and this sort of thing. So anyway, I ramble, but I still think it's a very important point. And I don't know how you feel about that as a non-religious person, Tyus, but I know that even as a religious person, I have a problem with this.
No, I agree. I mean, as a non-religious person, I've got all kinds of issues with this type of stuff. But, you know, I look back and when we see One Nation Under God being added, every presidential address, God bless America, for me, I look at that and I'm like, oh, these are all kind of violations of what the founding, our forefathers had in mind. And it's not to say that I'm against people having these beliefs. I'm just against these beliefs being pushed upon everybody. And that goes across the board, not only just for religion, but for just about everything. Basically, if you take these blanket policies and put them over our entire citizenship, that's where all these issues end up being really started from. So let's wrap this up because we've gone long, but you can just consider this a bonus, everybody. We just had a lot to talk about, so I hope you enjoyed it. Hey, if you want to get involved with our party, it is the fastest growing party, not only in the country, but especially in the state of Nevada. So please get involved. Come over, check us out at lpnevada.org, where you can find out how you can give us money, which we love your money. Or you can you can get involved by volunteering your time. We love that too. You could run for office. There's all kinds of things you can do to get involved. But you know what? None of that's going to happen unless you take some action. And if you care about the future of your county, your state, your country, or this world, there's nothing that's going to happen unless you get involved. Well, there's something's going to happen, but it won't be under your control. So go out and get involved, and we would love it if you got involved with us. So head over to lpnevada.org to find out how you can do that. And until next time, let's make it all about freedom.
This show is brought to you by the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Music is provided by T. Sims. Please support the show by subscribing, sharing it with friends, and leaving a positive review on iTunes. For more information or to learn how to get involved, visit lpnevada.org. Thank you for listening.